wasn't right that in their city, Radio 1 was the number one radio station. Those bastards! And it all came out. I think the most difficult acquisition was actually Children Group.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. Steve Orchard.
Northern industrial town upbringing. Coronation Street house. Mum worked in the cotton mill. Dad was a painter and decorator. So literally my formative years were in the cotton mill nursery, because these huge, dark, satanic mills had fantastic childcare. Who knew? And we played a lot of football in the street, and I was destined in my head to succeed George Best as Manchester United's inside left. I used to get these reports which kind of went along the lines of gets bored easily and therefore starts messing around and doesn't know when to stop telling jokes. Early years, looking back, a little bit bored, but just before my teens, I changed. I started to get very interested in reading, and there was a library just 100 yards from our house, and I spent most of my time in there, you know, just reading, and obsessed by facts about anything, and geography, and different countries, and, you know, how things worked. And so I'd describe myself as a curious boy. I think I still am a curious individual.
Yes, Mr. Brocklebank, I'm Lukin.
Oh, look, I made it for you myself. Look, James, it's a kite.
My earliest memory of radio is listening on Sunday lunchtime, just before the Sunday roast. And the one that I can remember is the Clitheroe kit. And we all thought it was hilariously funny, and I had the bonus of it. It was set in a northern context, and he was a naughty schoolboy, which obviously had a resonance.
Here is Jimmy Clitheroe as the Clitheroe Kid, with Peter Sinclair, Patricia Burke, Danny Ross, and Diana Day in
Licked by a Stamp.
I remember going to John Lewis's in Manchester, my mum buying Bruce Chanel's, I think it was Hey Baby, you know, bringing it home and very eagerly sticking it on the record player. And of course, you'd then play it 50 times without over and over and over again. Early teenage years, you then start to diverge from your parents' interests, and you start listening to music and actually radio as a one-to-one activity. You know, I'd have my radio up in the bedroom. The other thing as well as the music was the personalities. And I remember, so in the north, I missed most of the pirate radio stuff because you couldn't pick it up. But what you could hear was 208 and Tony Prince. And I was fascinated by the fact there was somebody else from Oldham and that he could be famous. And he got to be on the radio. And I was fascinated by everything about Tony Prince, the right royal ruler. And, you know, if I listened very carefully, I could still hear his northern accent.
Oh, we could go on all night, but we got the British service right now. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the English-speaking service of Radio Luxembourg.
Hey, start again!
So I was quite a studious teenager and got marked out by my history teacher, who said, look, I think you've got a talent. I'd like you to think about going to Oxford. And I won a place at Oxford and studied history there. And I took a year out, took a gap year, and went back to actually study as a social worker and became a full-time social worker. That's what I did as a career. Social work was really a vocation. And, you know, I realised, having arrived at Oxford, what a rarefied environment that was and how the world outside Oxford was very, very different, and how people faced huge challenges. And very often those challenges were as a result of circumstances which were simply not their fault. And that struck me as being very unfair. So it was a sense of social justice, really. And the way I translated that was by being a social worker, really specialising in childcare, children at risk. It was pretty harrowing, but I was a very satisfied and fulfilled social worker. But, you know, I had this itch that I needed to scratch, which was about playing songs on the radio and being a DJ. That came out of hospital radio, Radio Charwell in Oxford. And actually, I started to cover Oxford United as a football reporter, and Oxford didn't have a commercial radio station in those days. The nearest was WR, Wiltshire Radio. And they had a journalist called Steve Humphreys, and he arrived looking very miserable on a Tuesday night, Oxford United, third division, raining. I saw he had a Ewer, basically reel-to-reel. It was portable. You'd have to charge it for approximately 3 weeks to get 20 minutes usage out of it. And Steve Humphreys was sitting there miserable because his batteries had run out. And I said, why do you come all the way from Wootton Bassett to go there? And essentially, I said, do you want to borrow my Ewer? I said, I'll tell you what, why don't you go home? I'll do the recording for you and send it to you the next day. And for years, I used to say, you know, people say, how did you start in radio? I said, I was just lucky. But actually, I now realise that what I was ready. The person would say, can I have a go at that? I'll do that. And that goes back to curiosity, appetite for learning. And that's what led to me getting noticed by Ralph Bernard, who at the time was the managing director of Wiltshire Radio. Ralph used to do a Saturday lunchtime show called Saturday Super Gold. He took this very, very seriously. And I take it as a great compliment that Simon Cooper, who was the programme control at the time, felt that I was a safe pair of hands that could basically stand in for Ralph when he wasn't able to do the midday till two Saturday Super Gold show. I think in those days, anybody in radio management, I was in awe of, because they were getting paid for doing something I really wanted to do. And actually, I took a sabbatical from social work. I studied at the National Broadcasting School, which is where I first met Michael Bucht, who, of course, became the programme director, actually, of GWR Group eventually. By that stage, he'd been the launch programme director of Capital Radio.
There's nothing legal you can do that you can earn money at, right, that's half as much fun as running a radio station.
The other thing that happened to me in that period, I bumped into Phil Riley at a party in Oxford, and I could see this guy, and obviously Phil is at least 2 foot higher than anybody else in the room. I thought, I'm sure I know him. And I realised, I went and had a chat with him, and I realised that we actually were at school together in Oldham, and he was the year below me, still 2 foot taller than everybody else. I said, what do you do? And he said, I work for BRNB. So, of course, that was it. I latched onto Phil Ray. I thought, oh, you can get me into radio. I'm going to send you my demo tape, blah, blah, blah. I must have frightened him to death. And I sent him a demo tape of my hospital radio work. And about 2 weeks later, he wrote me a charming letter, a rejection letter, which explained that in order for BRNB to be interested in taking me on, I'd have to have a personality. There were so few radio stations, actually, when you look back on it. The barriers to entry, I think, were quite high. You know, and at that stage, Wiltshire Radio was putting together a merger with Radio West in Bristol, which was a failed commercial station, and they were auditioning for a breakfast show. The auditions actually took place on a Saturday lunchtime, and I covered Ralph's Saturday Super Gold programme for the period he was auditioning. And there was a gap in proceedings between switching from one DJ to another in the second studio, and Ralph thought he'd have a listen to what damage I was doing to his show, and said to Simon Cooper, this guy's good, why are we not auditioning him? He's really good. So Simon came to me and said, look, we think you've got something. Do you want to audition for the breakfast show? And again, I said, no, I can't. I'm a social worker. I'm just doing this for fun, really. And I did do an audition, and then they offered me a job. And that was the moment of truth, really. I had to make my mind up, because I realised I couldn't keep putting people off or turning down jobs. I've been offered a job at Radio Tees, now I've been offered the job at Wiltshire Radio, which was relaunching as GWR. So I justified the decision to accept it on the basis of do a couple of years, have some fun, and then go back to your real job of being a social worker. And I remember ringing my dad up and saying, oh, I've changed job. I'm going to be a DJ. He said, when you say job, what are they? Do you get paid for that? And I said, yeah, it's a job, Dad. I'm going to get paid more than social work. This is amazing. The studios were at the Watershed in Bristol, which is the old Eddie Shoestring studios. It was very beautiful and very showbiz. The HTV, the local TV channel, turned up to film the launch of GWR, the first merger of two commercial radio stations.
And so there we are, with the time approaching 4 minutes past 12, amid the anticipation of the new sound coming in just over 3 weeks to Bristol and the County of Avon. That's GWR. Obviously just a hint of sadness as well. Can I remind you that test transmissions for GWR begin at 6 a.m. this morning. In the meantime, and indeed for the last time, this is Mark Seaman on behalf of all the Radio West staff and presenters, both past and present.
We took Radio West off air, and I came on as the new duo with Richard Evans. My hand was shaking so much as I tried to lift the stylus onto the gram deck. You know, I had to grab hold of my wrist with the other hand to find the start point of the record, the 45. And the other thing, which I remember with this lovely engineer, Phil Bond, he's a lovely man, he gave me a tape, 10-inch reel or something like that. I said, right, record your first hour. And I recorded the first hour. And because I'd been working in hospital radio, what you do in hospital radio, you record everything in mono and then turn the tape over to get the next hour out of it. So I was very diligent and very economic and efficient. I thought, right, I'll now turn it over because I can get another hour out of this tape. So in turning it over, of course, what I did was record in stereo the second hour right over the first hour. So we lost the first hour of GWR broadcast as a result of that.
We're talking about you on GWR, radio 24 hours a day, every day from Tuesday, October the 1st. Listen, we're talking about you.
I think I was good. Actually, my peer group were also good. There was a bunch of us who went on to achieve quite high standards in radio presentation, you know, worked on networks and did very well. The fork I took was management. And what I'm absolutely convinced about is that I would have to have felt involved in some form of management or leadership. And that comes back to the, you know, the curiosity again of how things work. I love being on the radio. There's no question about it. It's a blast. It's great fun. But I also love coaching other talent, which frankly is better than I was on the air. You know, that is also a wonderful thing. GWR. A good pal of mine was the sponsorship and promotions manager, a guy called Simon Ward, who eventually became the commercial director of GWR Group. And he and I struck up a great friendship. And I became, through Simon really, very interested in the commercial aspects of deals and what could be done on air to create good programming that was interesting, but also make money for the radio company. You know, I was quite good at managing those projects, and there was a program controller vacancy initially actually in Moreton Bassett. So Simon Cooper managed the Bristol part of GWR, and I managed the Swindon output of GWR. We had a mixed speech and music format. So there was a lot of feature material in The Breakfast Show and in PM Drive and quite long news programmes. In fact, our lunchtime programme, when Ralph brought Johnny Walker back, it was a mixed interview and fast-moving news and music format where Johnny would interview people who were making news that day. So in the early days, I think there was that sort of, you know, we're committed to good broadcasting, we're committed to good presenters. I think it fitted that period very well. In later years, the situation changed. We split the frequencies, so AM and FM became separate entities. Radio 1 went through a period of change and we could see an opportunity there. So we actually changed tack because it became clear to us that Radio Bristol, which was the heritage station there, very, very difficult to knock off its perch. It was a commanding BBC local radio station with a big share. And we were looking at what was happening with Radio 1. And it, I think I'm right in saying it coincides with the time that Matthew Bannister and Trevor were having to overhaul Radio 1 because fundamentally, it was too old. It needed modernising.
I don't want to upset the audiences. I want them to feel that the radio station is indeed safe in my hands.
And it coincided actually with us starting to understand the potential of audience research. We weren't the first to use audience research. I think Michael Betton actually down on the South Coast probably was the first to use it. There was a system, BPR, who was still going actually, Bill Clements and Peter Don, who were fantastic at creating usable insight from research data. You know, there were things like the Stock Aitken and Waterman, you know, the beginnings of rap. And we could see that audiences under the age of 25 were pretty unhappy about the way that music was going and about the changes at Radio 1. And we did a lot of research and came up with a new format, initially just at GWR. And I remember actually sitting there, having done some focus groups and having looked through the data. We went out for an Indian in Bristol, me and Bill Clements, and we were trying to work out what our music position would be. And I think it was somebody I knew in the restaurant came up and said, "Oh, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, we're just talking about how Radio 1's doing this these days." And this person went, "Oh, God, Radio 1, it's just chat, 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 and then the music, rap, rap, rap." And Bill Clements, who's a very, very shrewd observer of how listeners think, said, "That's it. The new GWR, no rap, less chat." And I thought, that's never going to fly. And we played around with that for a while. And it was like lighting the blue touch paper. We basically repositioned as much more centrally AC radio stations and pinned our colours to the Tina Turner, Elton John, Rod Stewart, Fleetwood Mac, Simply Red. Oh my God, Simply Red. Every 5 minutes there'd be a Simply Red record, and the ratings absolutely flew. Anyone who ever held you. We also changed production. I'd been over to Australia to do some programmes back to the UK from there, and came across this surfer dude at a station on the Gold Coast called Grant Buckerfield. And he was a very interesting guy, you know, barely spoke two words. And then he played this stuff and, you know, he just came out of the speakers and grabbed you by the throat. And I thought, right, I'm taking you back to England with me. And we dropped all the jingle package. And I said to Grant, right, here's the position, no rap, less chat. Help us create the audio around this. Humour and kind of self-deprecation and, you know, sort of gentle cynicism behind it. And it really helped to sell the imagery of the new sound. Actually, he went on to write the theme tune for I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, for which he owns the copyright. So he's done very, very well for himself.
I'll be back in 5 or 6 days.
No, you'll be back in 5 or 6 pieces.
Wow. GWR-FM.
And really, me starting in management coincided with Ralph Bernard's insatiable appetite for merging and acquiring lots of groups. And we had a way of doing radio. We felt we had skills which were transportable to other radio stations. And there were a lot of unprofitable radio stations in those days. So we'd got this format, which was highly exportable. You could, you know, actually literally write down your, here's what to do, 2 weeks before relaunch, we're going to say this with our promos. 1 week to go in is we're going to take pages out in the newspaper with a listener checkup questionnaire.
Help us make it the best station ever by leaving your suggestions on the new Trent listener line. Get ready for a brand new FM sound on 96.2.
And we're going to take the station off air for 2 days and run a dramatic announcement saying this radio station has been seized on behalf of its listeners. And then bang, on Monday morning, we come with the new Trent FM or the new Chilton or whichever, typically a male-female breakfast duo. And that was the biggest challenge of all, finding the talent, you know, because really that's where, you know, the radio station's personality and its local connection came through that morning crew talent. And we went through a period of finding on-air talent from all sorts of different places inside the radio station. I remember Dirk Anthony coming to me one day saying, "Mate, the bloody sales execs are funnier than the bloody DJs in this place." And he was right. And, that's how Christian O'Connell got on air down at 2CR.
Wake up to Miller and Costello in the morning on the new 96 Trent FM.
I now can't actually remember the chronology of the rollouts. There were a lot of them. I think they started with Plymouth and Devonair, then 210 and 2CR. And those worked fantastically well, and we got fantastic radio results, actually probably Jikra in those days, I would imagine. And that really provided Ralph and the board with the platform to acquire other stations and principally groups. So there was Mid-Anglia Radio, which I think was Hereward and CNFM. Actually, CNFM, oh God, what it was such a poor radio station. And after about 2 days, we got one call from saying, "Is something going on the radio station? Have I missed something?" And, you know, these radio stations, they were in the wave of new licenses after the big cities and countywide stations had gone. And they never got a foothold. They were in too broad in too small a geographic market. And we made a success of them. I think actually the Midlands Radio Group was quite early. That was Trent, Leicester, Derby and Mercia. You know, we had such great success on ratings. The industry by this stage, I think collectively, were somewhat nervous about what we were doing, just rolling out this heavily formatted, duplicated service where you could spot a GWR station a mile off. You know, we had Greg, the voiceover, doing the same voiceovers, the same line as in every market. But you couldn't argue with the ratings and with the sales performance. So I'd go in and sort the programming, and Simon Ward, our commercial director, would do a fantastic job, bring the latest training and the latest, you know, the hottest consultants from across the world, and really did a fantastic job in skilling up our management and our salespeople. The new When we spoke to radio station staff, we were very conscious about the sensitivities involved. Because if you come in and go, "Guys, this is no good, we're going to do it this way," you're going to end up hitting obstacles very, very quickly. And you cannot be there all the time. You know, think about these groups. I used to laugh with Richard Park and Mark Story. But, you know, we'd roll up and it's a bit like a health minister visiting a hospital. Everybody's in the best behaviour. There's no problems here at all. And as soon as you disappear, you know it's going to go back to how it was before you visited. So you had to win hearts and minds. You can't deliver good radio unless people have passion and belief in what they're putting in and therefore what comes out of the speakers. And most sensible people, I think, could see that it wasn't right that in their city, Radio 1 was the number one radio station. That can't be right. There was a sense of appealing, I think, to their pride and their professional pride about, come on, we have to do better than this. Trent, I think we had more than 50 staff. And with 50 staff, you would have 50 different views on what should be done in that radio station. So we took a great deal of time to explain exactly what we were going to do. We talked about what we called inside-outside thinking, about inside the building. We would fret about how many Simply Red songs we were playing. But outside the building, listeners just don't think like that. You know, all they were hearing was this stream of fantastic music and really difficult message for DJs, not much chat. And it required us to coach DJs. Some of those rules that the pioneers of commercial radio had tried to instill in radio presenters. You know, if you listen to early commercial radio, be it the Pirates or the United Biscuits Network, those DJs didn't waffle. They knew that it was about the music.
Nancy Sinatra, and these boots are made for walking. I always remember the album cover that came from. I kept it hanging up on a studio wall for the longest time. It inspired me to great things. Careful, Nancy. Dad's watching. Here he is with Mrs. Robinson. See what I mean?
And here's to you.
You see in it a hugely formulaic approach to radio. But I'm absolutely convinced there was no other way of doing this. I think the most difficult acquisition was actually Chilton Group. From memory, it was a hostile acquisition. The story goes, and it may well be apocryphal, but the story goes that Colin Mason had toured the studios just before leaving, saying, brace yourselves. They're coming from Swindon. This is the end. He fought a good campaign, but it's all over now. And of course we got there and we were met with this wave of hostility. I remember we hired a big meeting room in a hotel. It was enormous. There must have been, I guess, 100 staff in there. And I spoke to a radio presenter a couple of years later, and he said it was like we felt we were being marched into a prison yard and we were about to be flogged.
Chilton Radio 96.9.
And we were very relaxed people, you know, the Anorak Press, you know, Now Radio, whatever it was called. Dear old Howard, rest in peace, was obsessed with, you know, slagging me off and, you know, saying what a terrible person I was. And it was actually quite easy to be nicer than that persona that was portrayed on the Anorak websites. It never got to me. I think he wouldn't admit it, but it did get to Ralph. It got to Ralph Bernard. And he said to me once, he said, oh God, they're having another, oh God. And I said to him, why are you reading that? Well, they're all, everybody's hundreds of them. And I said, just don't read it. They don't know what they're talking about. It's nothing to do with them. Just don't read it. There was a point where there was a particularly vicious editorial in Howard's weekly magazine. Was it Now Radio? Now Radio, yeah. It was actually libelous. And I rang him up and I said, you better get your lawyers ready. He wrote a very full apology and retraction the week after. And I think after that, things tended to calm down. The relationships with the regulator were poor because we were pushing the boundaries of, in particular, networking. And actually, there were many benefits. What people sometimes forget is that an important component of the relaunches we did was to put more local content in. We created more news bulletins. In some cases, we split the radio stations. We split Trent Derby and Trent Nottingham apart and formed Ram FM. We were very, very committed and saw the value of local programming. It's just that what went around it, the way you played the music, was very formulated and replicated right across the country. I had a direct relationship with people like Tony Stoller, with Martin Campbell, you know, with the various officers who on a one-to-one I got on very well with. But what we were doing was pushing as hard and as far as we could the regulations and stretching them, because that's what the commercial imperative was. There were, you know, a number of fallouts, and sometimes I thought the radio authority was being very petty about some points. I remember we had put on our website a picture of, I can't remember who the pop star was now, and I got a call from Martin saying, well, you've told us you're an AC format. Clearly you're playing all this kids' music and this is a breach of your format. I remember saying to Martin, you know, firstly, you don't you don't regulate the internet, as far as I'm aware. And secondly, who are you trying to protect? What are you trying to protect listeners from? You know, what is your fear? You know, so there were tense and difficult moments. I remember when Fergal Sharkey became a member of the Radio Authority, and he came up to Trent, and I met him in the building and said, I've heard all about you. We need to have a chat. And, you know, you kind of think that with the lead singer of the Undertones, you can be candid. you're going to be on the same page as him if you complain about authority. And he said, sum it up for me, some radio regulation up for me. And I said, all right, Fergal, it's all bollocks. LBC is also one of the radio stations we applied a relaunch format to. We used a lot of the techniques, a new station's coming, standby for changes, and a lot of the imaging had its roots in what we were doing in music radio. And actually, LBC, of course, had long gone. It was News Talk and News 97.3. And they're in those incredible buildings. Crown House. The audiences had long gone as soon as it stopped being LBC.
London, the 24-hour city in a 24-hour world. And now, 24-hour London News Radio, with its heart in the city.
And we decided that we had to bring LBC back, and that was my job, to bring LBC, the brand, back onto air. And I hired a talented programmer, a chap called Charles Golding, and he actually brought in Nick Ferrari, who of course has gone on to be an absolutely enormous success and a very important part of commercial radio's success. And I remember the night before we launched, I got a letter handed to me. It had been dropped off at the reception in Crown House. And it was from Mohammed Al-Fayed. Actually, it was from his lawyers. We understand you are launching as LBC tomorrow. You can't, because we own the name LBC, because we've got a radio station called London Broadcasting Company. And our conclusion is that we therefore own LBC, and therefore you cannot launch tomorrow as LBC. And I thought, oh God. Said to our lawyers, what do I do about this? And they said, nothing. If they had a case, you would have been injuncted, and they're just trying to scare you. And we went on and we put LBC back. And ultimately, what a success story that radio station is. And I think it is particularly grown as a result of Global's ownership of it and Global's investment in it. I wasn't involved in the launch of Classic FM, other than helping Michael Bocht understand the audience research. So I helped him do a bit of that, and then he became ill. And he got a terrible debilitating, I think it's called Meniere's disease, which is a disease of the inner ear. And he became quite ill and couldn't carry on. And the board said, Steve, you're our senior programmer. You have to go in and manage Classic FM. And I really pushed forward what Michael had started. So all those things about popular program strands, Classic FM at the movies, the chart show on Saturday morning. I took that, did more focus group research. I remember a group we labeled as Nervous Young Discoverers. And these were people who felt open to the idea of listening to some classical music, but the thought of Classic FM was a bit intimidating for them. So I started to really program it. I put a lunchtime request show on and Smooth Classics at 7. So we started programming it for mood. And again, Bill Clements, he said to me, the one idea that Classic FM must own above any other idea is relax. Because if people are confident in using it for their mood improvement, then you won't go far wrong. And he was dead right. He was absolutely right. Because the history of the music is important context, but it's not the reason people listen to Classic FM. That's the job of Radio 3. you know, we had a very talented team, and I, you know, although I was leading that team, you know, these were people who were so committed to building a world-class radio station. It was actually a very easy job in leading them. I was struggling with the repertoire because I'd come out of pop music radio, and that's what I understood, and actually rock. So I wasn't entirely confident about the repertoire. When I came up with Smooth Classics at 7, Anna used to come to me with these samples of music saying, is it this, is it this? And she'd say, do you mean, you know, is it more like Bach's blah, blah, blah? And give me the name of a Bach. And I'd have no idea. And I said, look, Anna, I want you to imagine you've had a particularly hard day at work. You get home and you decide to have an early bath, and you draw a particularly deep bubble bath, and you put a scented candle on the side and you relax. Give me the classical music soundtrack. And she went, ah. And that was it. If you're operating Classic FM, you have some formidable intellects you're dealing with. And I'd arrived on the train from Swindon. You know, they took a pretty dim view of me, having a view of how we could be better. And I think that when we got the first 6 million, it was the first time we'd gone through the 6 million mark. And that was a punch in the air moment. And, no, you know, no doubt it was a bit of fuck you. What GCAP achieved, I think, is very, very important. The experience was miserable. It was the clashing of two very different cultures. On the one hand, there was GWR, which was a kind of street fighting, for God's sake, don't spend any money on this, tie everything down, meeting the supreme brand of capital. And the twist in all this was that actually the halo of capital was still there. But the reality was that it had really gone past its peak. And that clashing of cultures was horrible. And not only that, but there were two of everything. There were two, an executive chairman, it was Ralph, a chief executive, who was David. There were two operations directors, me and Paul Davis. And we all absolutely loved each other and got on fine, but we were all trying to do the same job, and it was horrible. One of the reasons, of course, that capital had gone past its peak was that Richard Park had left. And to my mind, Richard still remains the best intuitive music radio programmer we've had in this industry. He's a genius. And we used to have these group program director lunches. We meet up every couple of months, and there'd be start off with five or six of us. Then it'd end up with three of us, as me, Richard, and Mark Story. And then I think EMAP decided they weren't going to have a group program director anymore. So it ended up as me and Richard, and we carried on. And we were due to have lunch on the day Richard left Capital. So it's pre-GCAP, it's GWR Group and Capital Group. And I said to my PA, ooh, this could be a bit awkward. Do you want to ring Richard's PA and say, shall we reschedule? And the message came back, on the contrary, Richard is very much looking forward to having lunch. We have lunch, and I'm thinking, wow, this is great timing. I'm going to find out why has Richard left Capital. Nobody saw this coming. Nobody outside Capital saw it coming. Probably everybody in Capital saw it coming. And Richard, as only Richard can, sits down at the table and says, well, Steve, I expect you're thinking I'm going to regale you with stories of some terrible fallout. I'm sorry to disappoint you. This is entirely the right timing for me, my decision, and it's about time I went and did something different. Now, let's order some champagne to celebrate a new chapter. I thought, fair enough. We have a glass of champagne. Then we have a bottle of claret. I think by that stage, we'd probably managed a starter. Halfway through the second bottle of claret, Richie goes, those bastards, and it all came out. The thing with Richard, I mean, you know, talk about wearing your heart on your sleeve, but what a talent to spot trend and hits just the way things were moving. You know, he sat, we were having lunch once, and he sat down, and I was, he was like mock sniffing the air, and he'd go, London, sex in the air everywhere. That's what Kiss have got absolutely right. Yes, it's all about sexy. And he was going off on that, and he's just brilliant. You know, he really understood the zeitgeist and, you know, what was hot and what could be hot. It was actually Richard who first said Stormzy, that's mainstream. Stormzy is mainstream and we got to play him. He's going to be huge. You can't do everything by research. If you have a radio station that is a contemporary music station, a CHR like Capital, what is it you're going to be researching? It's very different from programming an AC station. Whereas a CHR audience, you know, they want to be connected. They want to know what's happening. You know, what is the vibe today and what's going to be hot? And they don't want to be missing out. And you need talented, intuitive programmers to be able to do that. And there's none better than Richard.
My name's Richard Parker. I'm also director of broadcasting for Global Radio, which includes Classic FM, on which you broadcast.
GCAP was a miserable experience. The economic environment was poor. The city pressure on us was relentless. You know, let's not forget, running a PLC radio group is very, very different from running a private company. You know, our share price used to be essentially tied to the audience share of Capital. You know, up a quarter of a point in share, share price goes up. And we had invested a lot in digital radio. The returns from that were a lot slower than people had anticipated. But we were leaders of the UK's biggest commercial radio group. We had Classic FM, we had Capital, and we had that core of very successful local commercial radio stations, you know, the sort of backbone of the ILR network. There were some great times as well, and, you know, running brings its privileges. But I don't think anybody would say that that was the happiest time in their career, not at the management level. The alternative to a merger would have been for one party to acquire the other, to then clear out the management structure and to say, we're going to do it our way. But the deal could never have been done as an acquisition because both sets of shareholders had different views and were championing their side. Actually, when the parties did merge, the balance of value between the two was virtually 50-50.
All-time love, possibly one of the all-time greatest love songs from Will Young at London's 95.8, Capital FM, welcome to Monday, mainly cloudy.
When I got to take accountability for Capital, it was quite late in the GCAP period. And essentially, the Capital management resigned pretty quickly, despite us trying to persuade them to stay. We really believed in Johnny Vaughan as breakfast presenter. He is a fantastic talent. I think, you know, one of the most naturally effortless, funny, unique perspective.
That I've joined Capital.
So Johnny was a very important part of our strategy. We initially decided to move the music. We were very worried about CHR. So Radio 1 by that time was coming back strong. And we decided to move closer to an AC position, actually. Started to develop a format which was slightly more adult. Of course, Heart was doing very well by that stage. And really, we just got stuck. And we decided to return fully to CHR, and we brought Scott Muller in, program controller of GWR Bristol, Aussie, and he moved it much closer musically to what you hear Capital as today. It wasn't as good as Capital is today. The detail in the production is phenomenal. There is nothing at all left to chance. You know, this wave of colour and sound comes out of the speaker when you're listening to Capital Now. To me, that is about Ashley. That is about Ashley saying, this is how you do it. Not that, look, let me show you, let me get my hands on this.
Capital.
Counting days since my love up and got lost on me.
The background I have in social work has been very important in radio station management. You know, in social work, a crisis is a proper crisis. You're trying to take a child to a place of safety. Child is kicking you in the shins. The father's drunk and has set fire to the bedroom. The mother has passed out on heroin in the living room. You know, that's what a crisis is. And my old boss said to me, rule one of crisis intervention, Steve, don't join the crisis. Don't become part of it. And that is very valuable management insight. In the job of radio, nobody dies. You know, it's fun. We are a medium which listeners have a love affair with. And that's a wonderful, it's a happy place. It's a happy place, no matter, you know, what happens in the day-to-day running of it and the, you know, the disappointments. You know, how often have you said in a radio station, come on, guys, we do work in radio. You know, it could be work. We could be in a factory somewhere. I've always found that talent actually gets that. You know, I think some of the radio presenters that came out of the Radio 1 machine, I think they found it very difficult to adjust because their position in society and in media generally was so exalted because there was nothing else. These people were superstars. You know, you look at the millions and millions of people listening to them. And I think it was very difficult for a number of them to be in the commercial radio environment. I suppose what I understand is the importance of getting tuned in to that radio presenter's drive and fundamental reason for being there. And a radio presenter wants bigger audiences. He wants to be the star, or she wants to be the star. Confident in the skills and understanding what they're saying on the radio is enjoyed by listeners. A number of them, because they are hugely talented people and very articulate, have views which sometimes differ from yours. And of course, it would be very poor management and poor coaching to say, yes, but I'm the boss. So a large part of it is in recognizing their viewpoint, but in also being able to sell a different way of looking at things. I remember Chris Moyles, when we bought the Chilton Group, the Milton Keynes radio station. I think Chris was doing mid-mornings on Milton Keynes. And Chris came to see me. I was sitting in this open plan office. And he was 21, and I think he'd been fired 3 times already. He said to me, oh, I don't do formats, me. Oh, God, here we go. So I said, okay, a format delivers these things which I need to deliver for the radio station to sound a different way. What is it you do? And he said, I do comedy, me. I said, right, okay. I said, could your comedy fit into what I need the radio station to sound like? And he kind of sniffed a bit and he said, yeah, I think so, yeah. And I said, all right, if you go off, work a way out of you doing what you need to do, but helping me do what I need to do. And he went off, and I thought, I'm never going to see him again. Anyway, about a week later, I was up there again, and he sidles over to me. He said, oh, yeah, I think I can do it. And he slides this piece of paper over the desk, and there was this beautiful, crafted format, you know, with colour coding in it, and here's where I'm going to do the comedy, and here's where I'm going to do it. I thought, well done. You know, wouldn't be many presenters at 21 years old who would come and challenge me, stick with it, work at it, and come back. That marked him out in my mind as being different and being exceptional. Of course, we then know what happened to Chris Moyles. And about, it's probably 15 years ago now, I was with Joe, one of my kids. We were in Marlborough High Street. And I got this text. It was from Lucio, who used to do the Top 40 show. And he said, Steve, Chris Moyles' book is out. You're on page 83. So I thought, oh, wow, that's interesting. Because I hadn't worked with him then, I guess, for 10 years. Dragged Joe into WH Smith in Marlborough. We did what everybody else does. Picked the book off the shelf. I'm not buying it. And I find page 83. And Chris Moyles has put in capital letters, thank God for Steve Orchard. Right. And I show this very proudly to Joe. And he looks and he goes, yeah, yeah, yeah. But look at that, Dad. And he points to the next page where Chris Moyles has put in capital letters, everybody in commercial radio is a wanker.
All that and the Evening Brit right here on the Hot FM, plus your telephone calls.
Chiltern Radio, 01582.
When Ralph left, there was still a struggle for the soul of the company, which culture was going to prevail. And I applied for the chief exec's job, and Froop was absolutely brilliant and, you know, hugely talented, particularly on the commercial side. I don't think I've told anybody this story, but in the interview, there were three interview for the chief executive. The point at which you realize this job is not going to be yours is when one of the panel falls asleep during the interview. And I didn't. I'm thinking it was pretty obvious at that point that was not going to be my job. The consequence, you know, at that level, and they say, you're not going to run this company, that's the point at which your days are numbered, your race is run. I remember walking out of Leicester Square for the last time, and it was like a huge weight had been lifted from my shoulders. And, you know, it was almost a fresh start. I'm free. You know, because after that amount of time at that level, both operationally and in the PLC boards, the role defines you. And it was good to be free of that. You know, so I became chairman of a music publishing company which specializes in score. But as soon as that year was over, Ralph, Wendy Palo, who was the FD at GCAP, and myself got together and acquired our own radio assets. It's always an eye-opener sitting in negotiations with Ralph Bernard, because he is the best. I was missing radio. Ralph was missing radio. We felt very strongly we still had a lot to offer and that there was some value to be had. There were still underperforming radio stations.
On air, online,
and on Twitter at Banbury Sound.
We are the home of the biggest stories and local news.
There are some things at Quidem which have been extremely hard work, because there we are as tiny little radio stations when everything on the radio dial has moved to these big branded radio stations dominating, and certainly over the last two or three years, our differentiating point of local has just not been enough. That's been tough. We realised that actually the future would have to be very different for these radio stations.
The biggest stars.
Mr. Liam Bay.
Hi there.
Camille Cabello.
Yeah. How's it going?
The capital is coming.
The biggest.
Prism Radio is another thing that I contribute to. It's chaired by a wonderful campaigner for reform of the justice system called Roma Hooper, and Phil Maguire, who used to be Jeremy Vine's producer. It started off running radio programs and involving young lads in the Feltham Young Offenders Institution. And Phil had spotted that I had a social work background and a radio background, and that I also had commercial experience. So he basically came out and headhunted me out in Wiltshire. It is absolutely fantastic. I'm so proud of being involved. This is a project which works with people inside prison who've made some really stupid decisions in their life, and they have screwed up badly. it doesn't make them bad people. They're the same as you and me. They just made bad decisions. For some of them, being involved in radio is the first time they've started to communicate effectively with other people. So they tell their stories on air. They talk to other prisoners via the medium of radio. They interview politicians, prison governors, and they learn to listen to people. And you can see how, you know, presentation skills and broadcast skills are pretty fundamental life skills. The chances of them reoffending are dramatically reduced. I think that prison radio is certainly, you know, up there as one of the highlights of me being involved with this medium.
National Prison Radio is the world's first national radio station for prisoners. It can be heard in the cells of over 100 prisons across England and Wales. The Prison Radio Association is a charity.
I think with people who have an executive career at the level, there are sacrifices that your family has to make. There's no question that our choice to remain based in Wiltshire for our home life and for our kids' schools meant that they didn't see as much of me as a dad who would have been working locally. And that must have a cost. And you have to weigh that against the advantages it brings to your family about security, about quality of life, about education, about holidays, and all those things. Now, you know, going back to my roots as a lad in a, you know, tiny terraced house in Oldham, my dad, probably worry around now, would say you got that balance wrong. They'd have been better off with you being a patron decorator like me and but at least you were home every night. And I can hear him saying that, and there is a truth in it. And you make choices and you make sacrifices, but some of us, we're just driven on. We can't not keep pushing, and we cannot not look for opportunities and not throw ourselves in, you know, with a 200% commitment to try and develop something. But that's also what makes us great mums and dads as well, because our kids, you know, then start to develop some of those traits as well, and you kind of allow yourself a wry smile. I'm confident about what I am, and I'm confident about what I've given. I'm confident I've helped people produce the best that they can do. I'm confident there have been times I've helped radio talent, both on air and off air, get better. I'm confident I've launched some great radio stations, helped by outstanding individuals in my team. And I'm confident that I've played my part. Whether people remember that or don't remember it, that's up to them.
Steve Orchard. For more in this series, follow the Radio Moments Conversations podcast. I'm David Lloyd.